ओमयाम हिमिरंधस्याज्ञानंजन शलाकाया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. Just before I begin, I'll inform you that Sri Ram Maharaj was instrumental in probably the second most important turning stone in my life. The first one was to be allowed to join the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, and the second one was going to India to stay there and serve, which he took me in 1977, and I've been there more or less ever since. He was a senior sannyasi at that time. I was a 20-year-old kid. Now he's a 69-year-old kid, full of sprightly life. This evening I'm going to speak on pure bhakti. Recently in Southern California there was what was called a bhakti fest, a celebration of bhakti, not at all organized by ISKCON, organized by, well, people from New Age or whatever you want to call it, yoga background people. So it was bhakti, but mostly not exactly as we understand it from the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition that's given to us by Srila Prabhupada. So after that, I didn't attend, but afterward there was quite some discussion among devotees as to the pros and cons and the possibilities of many Americans taking up bhakti without knowledge of it, of the scientific process. So I suggested that a booklet could be compiled on the subject of pure bhakti to set out the principles systematically. And in pursuance of that suggestion, I'm going to speak on that subject, and then if anyone wants to, I don't expect anyone here to do it, but if anyone wants to transcribe that and edit it, then you can make a booklet. Bhakti means love or devotion. It is a word in the ancient Sanskrit language of India, associated with India, and the word is current in most Indian languages today. So that most people in India know the word bhakti. It's part of their vocabulary. That means over 1 billion people in this world are familiar with the concept of bhakti. Of course, yeah, now, first of all, through the activities of Srila Prabhupada, and now through the activities of and Srila Prabhupada is going to now through the activities of various other spiritual or quasi-spiritual leaders and their groups, bhakti is gradually becoming a known word in the Western world, just as in the Western world in languages like English and German, words from the Vedic tradition, words like yoga, and karma, samsara, moksha, they have become part of the English language, known to many people. I mean, the word karma must be known to... with the word goes the concept, so that's known, even if it's a flawed concept, but they have some idea in modern America. You'll find cartoons using the word karma. So that shows that it's a well-known word. So, what is the concept of bhakti? Is that love or devotion, or more precisely, it means religious or spiritual love or devotion. To love your dog is not generally considered bhakti. Although, sometimes the word is used in relation to one's family members, just like Pitri Bhakti, Matri Bhakti, Bhakti one's father or mother, but that's also within the Vedic tradition, that's also a religious, has a religious connotation, because the father and mother in the Vedic tradition traditionally are not taken just as biological parents, but they're expected to be guides in dharma, which simply put means the proper conduct of life. More recently, the politicians have introduced terms like desha bhakti, devotion to one's country, although nationalism is just another of the Western ideas that have been introduced into India. There was no conception of nationalism in traditional India. For that matter, democracy, cricket, which are more dear to Indians than, well, cricket especially, dearer than life to Indians, is cricket, and here they don't even know what cricket is. Cricket is a thing which makes a noise outside the window here, but in India it's, well, people go to temples, but they do go to temples, they're more interested in, they know more about Sachin Tendulkar than they do about Krishna. See, here non-Indians never heard of Sachin Tendulkar, but in India it's like worshipable, almost. He's a cricket. So, yeah, the cricket bhakti. How about that? In modern India. But that's a misuse of the term. Really, the term is, it's supposed to be religious or spiritual. And thus we hear about Krishna bhakti, Ganesh Bhakti, Mataji, for Mataji, that means for Durga Bhakti, like this. But actually, Bhakti means Krishna Bhakti. We'll get back to that later. The term Bhakti, it's generally understood like that, love or devotion, but there are different traditions within what is called Hinduism. Hinduism has been very much largely influenced by the ancient acharyas or spiritual teachers. Probably the most influential, even though many people in India don't know his name even now, but probably the most influential person on the religious culture of India and even beyond is Sri Shankaracharya, who preached Kevaladvaitavad or Mayavad, that ultimately everything is one. Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya. That which is spiritual is true or real, and this world doesn't really exist at all. That's his philosophy. Also very influential have been the acharyas of pure bhakti, who philosophically opposed Shankaracharya on many counts, not in all respects, but Shankaracharya said that the ultimate goal of life is to realize oneself as being spiritual and non-differentiated from what he called the non-differentiated Brahman. Whereas the acharyas of bhakti, particularly Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, Vishnu Swami Nimbarkacharya, Vallabhacharya, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and many others, but these are the prominent Sampradaya acharyas. They have promoted that the ultimate goal of life is Vishnu, and that to serve him is the ultimate perfection. To serve him, or bhakti for him, is the ultimate perfection. Now, these two, in modern Hinduism, these two strands mix. Most people perform bhakti of some sort. That means worship some deity or other, or something or other, or some person or other. Worship by offering incense, flowers, and various other items, and by singing the names of the deity who they worship. But if we, although they perform the activities of bhakti, most people have the idea that ultimately everything is one. Although most people are not very philosophical, but they have the idea. This is the underlying idea. And generally, in the West, it has been considered, even we'll find in encyclopedias written by people who should know better, that in Hinduism, the underlying current, all Hindus believe that ultimately everything is all one, which isn't at all true, because Madhva and Ramanuja especially very strongly oppose this idea that everything is all one. Now it does become more confusing because Shankaracharya also promoted bhakti. He said it's good, you should worship a god or gods, but his idea was that that's for people in the lower stage, and by doing bhakti they can gradually come to the platform of jnana, maybe after many lifetimes, and then of jnana or knowledge, which means spiritual knowledge, and then they can merge into the oneness which he talks about. So he promotes bhakti, but his conception of bhakti is quite different from that of the acharyas of bhakti, who say that bhakti is itself the highest process. It's not a means to come to another process. It's not a means for purification by which one becomes qualified for another process. So this idea that bhakti leads to jnana, or that bhakti culminates in merging with the object of one's worship. The idea that is that you worship Krishna, for instance, or you may worship Ganesh, and the idea that you become one with the God, so that you and the God become the same. But the acharyas of pure bhakti have opposed this. I won't get into the discussion because they're elaborate philosophical discussions. But this influence of impersonal is strongly opposed by the ancient acharyas of bhakti, and in the modern age by their successors, most notably Srila Prabhupada. He was very strongly opposed to this impersonalism, by which, in the words of Chaitanya Charitamrita, the savior sevaka bhava is destroyed. The distinction between the object of service and the served are destroyed, and that's the actual aim of impersonalism. But that's completely antithetical to actual bhakti. The idea that we can become one with the object of our worship. So this idea of becoming one, the idea that there's just pure exist in the ultimate pure state of spiritual consciousness. Everything is one, there's no differentiation, which means there's no love either. If everything is one, then there's no love, because love is to be shared between two sentient beings, or maybe more than two. So the Mayavadis, or the impersonalists, say that bhakti is a means to that leads to the end of realizing that there is no bhakti, that there is nothing at all, except just a state of undifferentiated consciousness. Whereas the Vaishnava Acharyas say that love is supreme. Above mere consciousness, love is supreme, and that love, that spiritual love, is not, as is often conceived among people who consider themselves to be spiritualists. Spiritual love is universal, but it's not vague. It's not just a vague sense of love. But there is a specific object of love. So it's like if you say, well, I love everyone. It's okay to say that, but to really love someone, you have to have an intimate relationship with them. You have to know who they are. Real love is very personal. If you say, well, we love everyone, it's vague, if not substantial. So the Vaishnava Acharyas, they promote this, that love is not simply a vague feeling of being nice to everyone, but there's a specific object and there are specific interactions. You can't love a cloud. I mean, you can say, I love the scenery, but it's not really, it's not love in the sense of love between people. So, love, the Vaishnava Acharyas have described that, or bhakti, means giving oneself. Love means to give oneself, which is maybe why in the modern world people are so unhappy, because the idea of getting for oneself is more prominent than the idea of giving oneself. But it's only by... But unless one gives oneself, one cannot love. And unless one loves, then he remains, and whatever else he does, he feels unfulfilled. And so, although people may talk of love, unless there's selfless giving of oneself, there is no actual love. And you can only give yourself, you can't give yourself to everyone. You can only intimately give yourself to one person or a limited number of people. So the idea that we love everyone, it means if you love everyone but we don't have any specific object of love, that means we don't, the love is mostly conceptual or imagination. So bhakti does not mean a vague sense of love, or a general sense of love, or just being nice to everyone, but it is, in the pristine system of bhakti, it is highly specific. It is established on an elaborate philosophical system. Now we think, well, what's that got to do with love? But the Vedic culture, at its highest stage, is based on the search for truth, atato brahma jignasa, that human life is meant for understanding spiritual truth. And unless there is a proper understanding of who we are and what is our interaction with the object of love, unless there's proper understanding, there cannot be proper love. If you say to someone, well, you don't understand me, that means if there's no it's an axiomatic point. If there's no proper understanding between people, then they cannot properly love each other.
Thank you.
An act of love. Practical.
Nice.
And love, I mean, even in the material world, love is very complex. It's not such a... Well, it's simple in one sense and complex in another, because conscious living beings are complex. So, love is subtle. Has its complexities. And the deeper the love is, then the more subtleties there are. Humans have very evolved consciousness compared to lower species, which is why, maybe one reason why we presume that humans can love in a way that animals cannot, because the consciousness is developed. So the Vedic culture is meant for elevation of consciousness, purification of consciousness, which is possible by first of all understanding who we are and what is our role within the universe. Actually, our role is to love. Ultimately, everything is meant for love, but unless we understand the specifics of that, then we may try to love, but we see that In the history of the world is one more of conflict than of love. So the Vedanta or Vedic system is an elaborate philosophical system which culminates in the philosophical underpinnings of the love which is the natural expression of the soul. Now, it may not be necessary for everyone to understand all of this, just like it's not necessary for everyone to be a psychologist. Although some people may be psychologists and understand the workings of the mind, and maybe help people who are having difficulties in their relationships and their relating to the world. So, some people should know how it all works. And for others, if they're naturally loving and kind, that's very good. If they're not, then they may need some help in that. So, the very fact that there is the traditional bhakti cults, they have an elaborate philosophical systems based on ancient scriptures. Well, that immediately establishes that it's a very serious undertaking. Whereas bhakti in India among certain people and in the modern West is often misunderstood to be simply feelings without any commitment and no, just feel it. But bhakti is a very serious undertaking and profound undertaking. Love, of course, means joyfulness, fun, happiness in associating with others. But it has a very real love is not just about the happiness of being with others that we like, but it's deep and profound. So, because love, yeah, it means that. It means fully giving oneself. Now, the scriptures and the acharyas of bhakti have analyzed that everyone craves for love. We may desire power, we may desire money, we may desire his prestige and recognition. But ultimately what everyone is looking for is love, because that is the nature of every living being. But the problem is that in this world, or in the material atmosphere, there is no possibility of loving as is our heart's desire, to properly, to fully love. To fully love means to fully give ourselves, but even if we attempt to do that, that love cannot be satisfied unless there is a person who can fully reciprocate that. Sometimes we see that some famous film star or music star dies and people commit suicide. John Lennon, when he died, some people... I was recently browsing through an encyclopedia. There was someone in the 1920s, a romantic Hollywood star, who I don't think anyone's heard of nowadays, except maybe a Hollywood historian of Hollywood. Some people waste their lives being historians of Hollywood. There's some romantic figure died, and there was a rash of female suicides after that. But no one knows his name even now. So, that's one problem with love in this world, that the object of love dies, or we ourselves die, and then the relationship is broken, so it's not eternal. And no one can fully reciprocate, even if we want to give ourselves fully, no one can fully reciprocate. But Shastra, or the ancient guides to reality as it is, and how we can connect with that, describes the perfect object of love, who is all attractive. Why are we attracted? In this world, we are attracted to people who have certain qualities. We desire to love people who have certain qualities. So someone who is very wealthy is attractive to others. Someone who is very physically or politically powerful is very attractive to others. Someone who is prestigious, popular, famous, they're attractive to others. Someone who is very physically beautiful is attractive to others. Someone whose personality is very beautiful, they're very kind, they're good with people, they're attractive to others. Someone who is very knowledgeable is attractive to others, or very intelligent. Someone who is detached from the world, who is not trying to exploit others, who's self-satisfied in themselves, these are attractive to others. So people who have these qualities, they become attractive to others. Just like someone who's very wealthy, they become well known for that. Bill Gates is internationally famous for his wealth. And what's your name? Jayananda Das is not internationally famous for his wealth. He has some wealth, probably less than 0.01% of what Bill Gates has. He has some wealth, but not enough to make him internationally famous. So Bill Gates is more attractive to others than Jayananda Das, to non-devotees. We like him more than Bill Gates. He's got another kind of wealth that Bill Gates doesn't have. We're talking theoretically here, or trying to make a logical argument. So, Aishvaryasya, Samagrasya, Viryasya, someone who is very powerful physically, becomes attractive to others. Arnold Schreckenhager or something like that. I guess he's a bit over the hill nowadays, but he's probably got a big punch by now. But there was a time when he was very attractive. And there must be someone else nowadays who's big hunk of meat and attractive, or politically powerful, someone who's politically powerful. We didn't know the name of Barack Obama until he came up and became the President of America, when he was just Mr. Obama and not the governor of wherever he was the governor of before he became the president. People didn't care, but when he's got power, he's famous.
Senator.
He was a senator. Sorry, I'm not much up on the American political... I'm not much up on the American political system. Forgive my ignorance. So like that, you'll see, as long as someone's in power, then his name's in the newspaper every day. But when they get out of power, then people don't care for them so much. The power is attractive, either political or physical or in whatever way people have power, they become objects of attraction. Various, someone who somehow or other is famous become attractive to us. Therefore, people do stupid things like eating motor cars a few filings a day at a time, so they can get in the Guinness Book of Records. Or someone shot John Lennon. It seems he just wanted to get famous. That's one way. John Lennon, ever heard of John Lennon? He'll be forgotten soon enough. So, you somehow or other become famous because it has some kind of attraction. Shriya, one who's beautiful, becomes attractive. The problem with beauty in this world is that however many facelifts you do, or however much vitamin E cream you rub on your face, beauty doesn't last. In a magazine, a devotee showed me some years ago, there were two photographs just juxtaposed against each other in the magazine. One of Brigitte Bardot, who was considered extraordinarily beautiful, French actress, when she was young, and a picture of her now with lot of wrinkles on her face. Same face, same body, 40 years later. What a difference. Nowadays, no one will be attracted to such a body. But as long as she was beautiful, then it was very attractive. And that's the problem. It doesn't last. And for that matter, the beauty of this material, the beauty of a beautiful woman is, as they say, skin deep. The same body, of any beautiful woman, if you just remove one organ called the skin, and have to show the same body, he will vomit to see it. So, Shriya Gyana, someone who has knowledge or is intelligent, they're considered attractive. Albert Einstein was voted Man of the Century by Time magazine readers of the 20th century. Very knowledgeable person. And if someone has a PhD, then people who are not totally gross consider that to be something of an achievement. So that is attractive, and maybe not very much in American culture, but in Indian culture or religious cultures generally throughout the world, traditionally people who had renunciation in non-Protestant cultures, they were considered an admirable quality. If someone can be offered wells, but they're detached. They're not attached to material enjoyment. So these are all attractive qualities. And Vedic literature describes that the person inadequately named in the English language as God, the person who in Vedic language is called Bhagawan, or the possessor of all opulences. Bhagawan is the person who has all of these qualities that make him attractive. And therefore, bhakti is meant for Bhagavan. Now, Bhagavan is the person who can fully reciprocate with everyone, because even though he's a person, he is the Supreme, and he has the ability to enter into everyone's heart and to fully reciprocate love with everyone, because he is unlimited. So the person, Bhagavan, is the name of the position, you can say, of being God, of being Supreme, the Supreme Person, Supreme Personality of Godhead. And his specific name is Krishna, which means all attractive. So actually, bhakti can only, in its true sense, bhakti can only be for Krishna. Bhakti means, or pure bhakti, means that in which we fully give ourselves, fully love, and fully devote ourselves, and that is only sustainable in relationship to Krishna. Krishna is constitutionally, eternally, the object of love for all living beings, and all living beings, their constitutional or natural intrinsic position is to love Krishna, and that is bhakti. So this is described in Shastra, which is of Veda, which is sometimes interpreted or translated as scripture, but it's not exactly scripture in as we understand it in the Abrahamic religions. Shastra is a manual for living in the world. It's a description of the reality that we are supposed to come into contact with, living in this illusory atmosphere. Just like Srila Prabhupada gave the example, when you purchase a microphone, a manual comes with it, which tells you what it's for, how to use it, how to get the best out of it. Otherwise, if you just take a microphone, you have no idea what it's for. You could use it for other things other than amplifying sound. You could use it for, you could maybe roll chapatis with it, you could try that. You could hit someone on the head with it, you could stir the dal with it. You could do various things with it. But its proper use is to amplify sound. And to do that, you have to look after it properly. You have to, various switches and knobs you have to adjust to get the best use out of it. So in the same way, the Shastra, or Vedic knowledge, it is a massive body of instruction, guidance, advice for how to live in this world. What is the, first of all, what is the purpose of the world? What is our purpose in this world? And how we can live in this world in a manner that will help us to, at least gradually, fulfill our highest purpose, which is to love Krishna. That is bhakti, that is the natural position of the soul. Krishna is the center of all that be, therefore he is to be loved, and love directed toward him can flourish unlimitedly, whereas love directed towards, he is infinite. Whereas if we try to direct love towards other infinitesimal persons like ourselves, then that love cannot develop properly. And if we try to restrict our love to persons in this world without understanding that the proper object of love is Krishna, then that love will not only be frustrated, which is the history of the whole world, but to love one person or one set of persons, just like loving, I love my country, I love America, whatever your country may be. Well, that immediately sets up a duality of love and hate. like and dislike. I love America, therefore I hate anyone who doesn't like America. Or I love the Alabama Bulldogs, therefore I hate the Arkansas Hogs, I was told. See, I'm learning about American culture also. Highly advanced country where they have people identify themselves as dogs or hogs, depending on depending on which part of the country they're from. So in this world, yeah, but actually it's a fact. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, and it is. But people identify themselves with a certain area, and then they have a sports team, and they identify themselves with that. And half the fun, as I remember from my foolish childhood, in supporting a sports team is hating the rival team. Like, you love one means you, if you love this team or club, then you have to hate others. So love in this world is necessarily mixed with envy, hatred. The duality of like and dislike comes. But if we love Krishna, who is the center of all existence and the sustenance of all existence, then it is possible to love all others. Just like if we throw a stone into a clear pond. If you throw stones all in the same point, it produces concentric ripples. But if we throw it all in different points, then that harmony will be disharmonious. So the central point we have to understand is Krishna. Or another example is that Krishna is the proper object of love. Just like if we water the root of a tree, if we know the proper place to water the tree, then the leaves, branches, twigs, fruits, flowers, everything will be properly nourished. Whereas if we try to individually water the twigs, leaves, branches, fruits and flowers, then nothing will be properly nourished. Or if we put food in the stomach, we know that that's the proper place to put food, then all the body becomes nourished. Whereas if we think, well, I'm having, my sense of hearing is going down, so let me stuff some food in my ear to get it more nourished. It doesn't work. There's a proper way of doing things. So the source of everything is Krishna. And if we give everything to Krishna, then we can properly interact with all living beings. Whereas if we try to circumvent Krishna or avoid Krishna, or if out of ignorance we don't place our love, we don't direct our love towards the proper object of love, then even though we may have good intentions, but the result will not be as we desire it, because of not knowing how to properly direct our loving, the loving propensity, which is the natural propensity of everyone. So, shall I go on longer or stop there? It has to be more specific, not vague. Should continue. All right, I have one affirmation, so I think that is it. The scriptures, they describe this specific love and the specific process of loving. Although it may sound strange, because you think that love, well, it's just natural and flowing. Well, that's true. It is our intrinsic propensity to have love for Krishna. But we are presently in a condition where our natural propensity has become perverted into an unnatural propensity of trying to exploit others in this material world. So even if we try to love, we realize that, well, we shouldn't be exploiting others, we should be loving others. if we try to love, but we're not guided how to come out of our exploitive tendency, and how we can actually love, then we won't be able to properly. We need guidance to revive our perfect bhakti, which means pure bhakti. Perfect bhakti liberates us from this material world, whereas bhakti, if not properly, or love, if not properly directed, it binds us in material life. Real, the pure condition of the jiva, of the spiritual soul, is beyond mundane attraction and repulsion, like and dislike, love and hate. That is possible only in pure bhakti, which means giving oneself unmotivatedly. Now, giving oneself unmotivatedly means to become, to offer service, unmotivated service, to voluntarily accept a position of service. It's not just an inner feeling of general well-wishing to others, but it actually means to take a position of service, to perform selfless activity for the object of love. This is defined anyabhilashita shunyam jnana kama dhyanavritam anukulyena krishnanushilanam bhakti rutam. That pure bhakti is that which is performed with no other motive than to satisfy the object of love, who is Krishna. And neither on the intellectual platform, nor on the gross sensual platform, should one desire anything else but the satisfaction of Krishna. That is pure love. It's a very high standard. Serving Him for His sake. And we find in the literature of bhakti that there are many such statements that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, even if he apparently mistreats me. Krishna never actually mistreats anyone. But sometimes, as a love spot, he may apparently mistreat his devotees to see if they are serving him for their pleasure or for his pleasure. Are they fully surrendered to him or not? So, love, bhakti, means to serve Krishna for His happiness without any personal desire. To do that, one has to have full trust. You cannot give yourself fully to someone unless you fully trust them. So that's why one has to be convinced philosophically that Krishna is the object of love. He is our well-wisher. Because if we give ourselves to someone, we're afraid that they'll exploit that. They'll exploit, cautious to trust others, because we're afraid that if we trust them, they'll exploit us. So, we have to understand philosophically that Krishna is that person who will not exploit us, who, by loving Him, our own best self-interest will be served in the best possible manner. And that by failing to serve Him, our own self-interest can never be properly fulfilled. So that's a philosophical approach. But then love, it's of course the actual love, it's not calculating philosophically. The trust is something we can talk about, but it is a commitment of giving ourselves to others, or specifically to Krishna. So, love is contrasted, or pure bhakti, is contrasted to the love of this material world as follows. Atendriya priti vancha tare bale kam, Krishnendriya priti ichhad hare premanam. The love of this, or the love of this material world, or desire of this material world, that is centered on one's own personal satisfaction. But actual love for Krishna, that is called prema, and that is executed simply for Krishna's satisfaction. But because we are part and parcel of Krishna, actually we become unlimitedly happy by serving Krishna. That is the secret. That if we don't, because we are constitutionally linked with Krishna, inseparably linked from Krishna, so if we try to forget Krishna, or not serve Him, or try to serve ourselves, it's like the hand thinking, well, I'll just eat by myself, I'll mush up the food and merge it in myself. But the bodily parts, they think, the ear thinks, okay, I'll take the food for myself. It doesn't work. Our self-interest is fulfilled by serving Krishna. But even when we forget that my self-interest is for serving Krishna, the natural attraction to Krishna is such. Krishna is, we're talking in a theoretical way here, a philosophical way, but actually Krishna is a loving, the loving person. So if we love Him, our interest is fulfilled. But even without thinking of our own self-interest, if we simply give ourselves Him in full trust and full love, that is called praying, and that is the platform of bliss, spiritual bliss, beyond any personal consideration.
It is like a leap.
Yeah, okay.
I'm afraid of breaking my bones is such a leap.
Okay, I'll get to that. That's considered. So serving in expectation of reward is business. That I'll serve God with the expectation that I'll get something back. I'll get His blessing, or He'll protect me from harm, like that. But loving, even for the sake of one's own happiness, that is another personal desire. So that is actually contrary to actual love, which means fully giving oneself. So if one loves for the sake of feeling good, it feels good to me, that's also not actual love. Actual love means giving oneself to Krishna. Therefore, pure devotees, they decry bhakti, which is to anyone other than Krishna. That's not proper, but cannot be proper bhakti. Or they also decry that bhakti, which is done even to Krishna, but which is done with the idea of how I will enjoy. If we perform bhakti to Krishna, naturally we'll become happy. But if we do it for the sake of our own happiness, that's not bhakti. Yes, so it does require great faith. It's a leap. No, we don't recommend leaping. Step by step. Try to understand. If we try to leap, we won't reach the goal. I'll get back to that later. Actually, I'm really going through quickly, so if you can kindly wait for 5 or 10 minutes, I'll finish this presentation. Yeah, so all this kind of general, non-specific bhakti, which is not directed toward anyone in particular, that cannot be. All this is decried by the Vaishnava Acharyas. Pure bhakti is in 5 rasas. In the spiritual world, there is a spiritual world where everything goes on the basis of love. And that love is not of this material world, therefore it is, everyone is fully surrendered to Krishna, and everyone is harmonious on the point of Krishna, and therefore the love in this world doesn't produce, the love of that world is not contaminated or mitigated by the hate that got that art that is in this world. I love America, therefore I hate whoever America's enemies may be. The pure bhakti is performed in every living being has their own rasa or relationship with Krishna, which fall in five general categories. Those whose the rasa of neutrality, shanta rasa, in which one as a particle of earth or a particle of water in the river or the tree or blade of grass, they also serve Krishna, but in a neutral or non-active way. They appreciate Krishna. So that's the bhakti in service, bhakti, love means service, that is executed by those who have great reverence for Krishna, and they serve, they perform various personal services. Then they are friends of Krishna, who, even though he is supreme, because of their friendly, because they love him so intimately, they may even forget that he is supreme and interact with him in a very intimate way. There are parents, they take the role of the parent of Krishna, even though he is the source of everything and the Lord of everything, to reciprocate that relationship of love that parents have for children, as we see in this world. Some devotees take the role of Krishna's parents, although in this world that love of a parent for a child, although should be very strong, it's not perfect and complete as it is in the spiritual world with Krishna. And some devotees, they take the or their natural feeling toward Krishna is like that of a lover for the beloved. And in this material world, the perverted reflection of that is mundane love affairs. But the attraction, the female attraction towards Krishna as the supreme male, is completely pure and free of any mundane overtones. Pure bhakti can also be performed toward various avatars of Krishna. Krishna has many forms, as Matsya, Kurma, Varaha, Vamana, Rama. So different, every devotee, every living being in existence, so they're unlimited, they all have their own personal intimate relationship with Krishna. And some are attracted to him as Rama, the ideal king. Some are attracted to him as Nrsimha, the half man, half lion form. And devotees are attracted to Krishna also in various ways, as in neutrality, in servitorship, in friendship, in parental mood, and in the mood of a lover. So to go from the selfishness of that characterizes the material condition to the selflessness of pure bhakti, that requires training, and that training is called bhakti yoga. Yoga means to link with the supreme, which requires, in any yoga system, although people in the West, the way yoga is taught nowadays, people think it's a means to make their body healthy for enjoying this world, but actually yoga is meant for withdrawing the senses from this world, becoming detached from the spirit of enjoyment of this world. So that training is required in bhakti yoga, training in withdrawing the senses and gradually increasing one's faith in Krishna. We don't expect people to overnight, it's not practical that people can overnight change from being a total materialist to being a fully perfect spiritualist. Some people, there may be cases of that, but generally it requires training and purification according to the system of bhakti yoga. So again, bhakti is not simply some kind of imagined feeling of love, but there is a training, purification, by which one can by the system of bhakti yoga, by which one can become gradually free from the attraction to the material world, which is the cause of our not being able to properly love, because we try to love in the material atmosphere. And then a training in activities that increase our love for Krishna. If we just think without training in sense control, without understanding who Krishna is, without accepting guidance, we can simply feel spiritual love in a vague way. This is not accepted by those who are actually pure devotees of Krishna. This is called the Prakrita Sahajya Bhava, those who take everything very cheaply. Pure love for Krishna is extremely profound, and to take it as being something so easy that you can just without knowing anything about it, you can just turn yourself from being a materialist to a complete spiritualist overnight, or without even understanding the whole process or the science, what actually results is that such people, although they may speak of bhakti, they actually remain attracted to material sense enjoyment, which means they don't have bhakti at all. And such bhakti, so-called bhakti, simply creates a disturbance in society, because it becomes more difficult to train people, to show people what is the actual path of bhakti that can actually help them. And so in the name of bhakti, what people are doing is they're not actually performing bhakti, but because they call it bhakti, and it, to people who don't know, it resembles bhakti. So it actually makes it more difficult to teach people what is actually bhakti when it's being misrepresented. So, one has to become free from... Actual bhakti means to be free of all gross and subtle desires, and dovetail all desires in the service of Krishna. So this bhakti yoga system, it incorporates much of the genuine yoga system described in Bhagavad Gita and in Patanjali Yoga Sutras, but it is a much more natural, simple and effective process. It's simply to try to control the senses without focusing them on Krishna is very difficult, but the natural process of engaging the services in Krishna's service is very natural and pleasing to the soul. Just like, for instance, we like to see something beautiful in this world. But if we see the form of Krishna, then it's very beautiful. So if we're attracted to Krishna, then we won't be attracted to the beauty of this world. In bhakti, there are nine basic processes, and there are many other details. The nine processes are hearing about Krishna, chanting about Krishna, remembering Krishna, serving the feet of Krishna, worshipping the deity of Krishna, praying to Krishna, identifying oneself as the servant of Krishna, identifying oneself as a friend of Krishna, and completely surrendering oneself to Krishna. This surrender is essential. That is the difference between imagined bhakti and actual bhakti, pure bhakti, is that one actually surrenders. And what is surrender? That's also described in the bhakti literature, but I don't have much time to elaborate on that now. This process of bhakti is described in the book The Nectar of Devotion, which describes, it's the complete overview of what is bhakti, the necessity of it, and how we can incorporate that in our lives. And that's recommended study for everyone who wants to know what is pure bhakti. So Hare Krishna, thank you for patiently listening.
If anyone has any questions, comments, or protests?
I protest.
Oh, you're boxing. Oh, yeah.
When I was talking about that, the leap, what I was thinking of is that the intermediate is the transplant by media. You were just talking about love of Krishna, but that sometimes Prabhupada said, I don't know Krishna, but I know my spiritual master.
Yeah, spiritual master is essentially. I didn't.
I was just thinking, in the future, you'd want to incorporate that in your presentation, because for me, it's like, it does say, you know, you could, Prabhupada, by meeting somebody like Prabhupada, you could learn that this is not just theoretical, you can actually love this person. He has all the qualities, not the same as Krishna, but that he's lovable. And Krishna also recommends that, that he wants an all-meeting.
In the process of bhakti yoga, association with devotees is essential. And by associating with devotees, we can understand that bhakti, the presentation I made sounds quite theoretical, but when we associate with devotees, that we know we come to
especially devotee of that platform.
Yeah, it becomes tangible. So we should associate with devotees and engage in the activities for pure devotional service, and we have seen in this world.
Right, and sometimes they're considered more kind than the Lord because, you know, Prabhupada got on a boat, came to New York, had big trouble. But Krishna was already here, but Prabhupada was canvassing. He was reaching out and forgiving us and shaking us. Krishna's in our heart, but Prabhupada was.
He gave us Krishna. Krishna Shetoma, Krishna Dite Paro, Tomara Shatatiyas. Amitu Kundal, Krishna Krishna Bali, Dhai Kalapas. But you have taught the sins of the Vaishnava. O venerable Vaishnava, ocean of mercy. Krishna Shaitoma, yes. Krishna is yours, you can give me Krishna. Krishna Shaitoma, Krishna, you have the ability to do so. I'm running after you, calling out Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. Yeah, anything else, please? Anyone else want to say anything else?
Yes.
You're only one question, that's good.
You were touching on the point, Maharaj, of how you're giving the example of how if somebody loves their country, then they hate the opposite. So we see often in religion, I'm Muslim, I love my way, but I hate your way. This idea of Hinduism comes into play, where our process.
Oh yeah, I forgot to make that point. That Hinduism, it's not. It's a conventional term, but it's not a scriptural term.
I had this stirred this question to me is before I came this evening I had a phone call because my number is the temple number. And there was a man on the phone, he said, are you feeding Ganesh today? And I said, no. And he said, well, you're feeding Krishna today? I said, do we feed Krishna every day? Throughout the day. And he said, no, there's a special festival today. You're feeding Ganesh milk. This is a Hindu temple? And I said, no, we're not Hindu temple, because, oh, you're not Hindu. Okay. So this mixture of conception is there. Where often sometimes it's, you know, it's kind of mixed. It's not so straightly defined.
Well, I this is an outline, and then that can be transcribed and maybe so that we can make the point that Hinduism is a conventional term which is used by people who don't really understand that this is the Vedic scriptures. They don't mention the word Hindu as an exposition of truth. It's not a sectarian religion. Bhakti transcends sectarian religion in which there is the same spirit of love and hate is there. Someone think, I'm a member of this religion, therefore I hate members of that religion. I'm a member of this sect of this religion, therefore I hate members of that sect of that religion. But bhakti brings us to the actual fact on the soul. There's no hatred of others. There may be, for the sake of revealing the necessary understanding. There may be condemnation of those who misrepresent or mislead others in this world. But that's not on the platform of hatred. It's for the benefit of others, you point out. That's why philosophy is required. Otherwise, people just come and say, well, my way is right, your way is wrong, but there's no proper understanding. So it must be on the material platform. Unless there's proper understanding, then it must be on the platform of misunderstanding. And it's just feelings, emotions, sectarian bias. Yeah, anything else, Chris?
My question was that, like, after hearing about philosophy, what it is and what it is not, practitioners, unified like myself, we think that there's a long way to go. So how do we keep that enthusiasm? So that
there's a long way to go. How do we keep that enthusiasm? Well, if we follow the process, then naturally we'll be enthusiastic, because we'll make them hear about Krishna, we'll be inspired to, and we'll be attracted to.
Shanti Chara, not that.
Yeah, anyone else? All right, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Shri Prabhupada ki
jai,
Hare Krishna. That's what Maharaj ki jai.